It's time to take the quiz.
5 questions, 5 minutes a day, 5 days a week.
Take the quiz every weekday at thequiz.fox and then listen to the quiz podcast to find out how you did.
Play, share, and of course, listen to the quiz at thequiz.fox.
Hey, everybody. It's the one. It's been a long time. It's been like months. I didn't think it would last this long, but it just seems to never end. So I said, damn it, I'm going to restart the podcast. And I'm so excited with my first guest is somebody that I've been thinking about for a long time. It's such a weird story. Back when I was a teenager, I guess it had to be 78 or 1977. I'm not sure. There's this guy that puts out an amazing album. Every song on it has a killer pop hook. And everybody loves it. It's played on the radio all the time in Northern California, where I'm from. The album was called Close Personal Friend. And it was incredible. I went and actually saw this guy. I was like, I might have been the first concert I went to. He was opening for the Knack and the Police. And I saw him at Zellerbach Auditorium. I think that was either my first concert or it was when I went and saw Cheap Trick and Blue Oyster Cult, which was around the same time. But who cares? The fact is, I thought this guy was going to, like, he was amazing. And then there's no second album. He just kind of, like, rides off into the sunset. It's the weirdest thing. And so I've been trying to track him down. His name is Robert Johnson. I know there's other people named Robert Johnson. This is a different Robert Johnson. This guy has been collaborating with everybody, from ZZ Top, the Rolling Stones, Mark Bolan, John Entwistle, even the Judds, and Sesame Street. He's got a new album out. I'm so shocked to hear that he has a new album out. And hilariously, it's called I'm Alive, because I thought he was dead. Robert, how are you?
Hey, Greg. I'm doing really well, and it's an honor to be the chosen one for the Greg Gutfeld Podcast Comeback Special 2020.
Yes. Yes.
The world has missed you. The radio world has missed you. There you go. I had to put in a couple of power chords for you.
You play, you know what's interesting? You play really fast, don't you? I mean, the guitar work in the first album was pretty quick for something that would, I guess you would call power pop. It was more, almost, I hate to say it, it was like you combined punk and thrash in your speed. Does that make any sense?
It does a little bit. I think there was a disc jockey in London named Nicky Horn. You might remember him. Mm-hmm. He mentioned something similar in print, which was you guys are on the same wavelength.
Yeah. Can you explain to me, I don't know, succinctly, or why you put out this amazing album, it's a hit, and then it's like you're gone. So what happened? Where did you go? I mean, you obviously didn't go anywhere. You're here. You're alive. But I'm just wondering what changed.
Well, I had one of the great all-time record business stories of misfortune. I tried to get a record deal early on, about after I got out of John Entwistle's band, The Ox, which would have been probably summer of 75. I started really trying to, you know, people wanted me to do my own record. So we did a record for Chrysalis under the name of Lash LaRue, which was myself, my bass player from Close Personal Friend, David Cochran, and Chad Cromwell, who was our first drummer, who ended up being Neil Young's drummer on Rockin' in the Free Worlds, played with McCartney. He's a wonderful drummer. And we did this record for Chrysalis and couldn't get any traction from it because disco was at its peak and there was just not any room for, there was no power pop, no punk rock yet. So that record kind of transposed into Close Personal Friend. So when punk rock came about in England, I was just back in Memphis doing nothing, working as a session guitarist. And one day I got like 7 record deal offers in the mail. And then I had signed a publishing deal while I was there in 75. So the publishers had put together 7 deal offers. And then when punk rock came, it just opened up everything for me. So I immediately flew to England and then came back. And then the president of Ensign Records knocked on my door in Memphis one day and unexpected and says, I'm the guy you need to sign with. I have the number one record in England with the Boomtown Rats with Bob Geldof. And we want you on the label. I said, hey, you're the only person that's knocked on my door, although I do have seven other offers. Anyways, we ended up signing with them, but we didn't have a record deal in America. So the day before, we were going to fly to New York and license me and Bob Geldof and the Boomtown Rats to Columbia. We'd all agreed that Columbia was the best choice in New York. The day before, we were getting on the Concorde to fly over from London to New York to sign and clinch the deal with Columbia to put out the record in America, in North America. Ronald Luxemburg, the president of Epic Records, was in the Ensign office in London and said, hey, let me hear some of your tracks. So he heard I'll Be Waiting off my Close Personal Friend record and immediately said he wanted to sign me and asked what the Columbia deal was and doubled the amount of the advance from $75,000 to $150,000. So
wow.
He didn't want, he passed on the Boomtown Rats. And then once things started getting going, I knew that, I was in a little bit of trouble and that the label was doomed. It was easy to tell that something was going to crash and burn. And 18 months later, they were shut down after spending $40 million on a lot of bad music groups and solo artists. So, you work your whole life getting to that point, and then, all of a sudden you got this tangled up mess with the label and contracts, and then they're out of business. And it was very heartbreaking. So I just kind of gave it a break for a minute and ended up just going back doing what I did before, just being a session guitarist and kind of like being a little bit bummed out. And by then, the world had changed, a couple of years later. So I just kept doing the RJ thing. So that's kind of the long-winded story.
It's a good story. I mean, it explains a lot. You have such an interesting background, though. I mean, you played with a lot of people, and you auditioned for the Rolling Stones. What year was that? And you got to tell that story.
Well, that is correct. I was playing in the fall of 1974. I was in John Entwistle's band. I'd auditioned for his band in London amongst 200 other people that were trying out to play with the world's greatest bass player. And so when I got the job, immediately the producers and all the people around him started inviting me to other sessions. So we did a record called Flash Fearless versus the Zorg Women, which was a big comic book sort of a Broadway type play, a production with a vinyl record and a comic book. Is a huge thing, but it had some all-star cast. It had like Rod Stewart, Alice Cooper, Leo Sayer, a bunch of people. Then it had Kenny Jones and Bill Bruford. Nicky Hopkins was doing the keys. So it was me, Bill Bruford, and Nicky Hopkins, the Rolling Stones keyboard player, were doing most of the meat and potatoes of the backing tracks. So one day in December, we were at Wessex Studio in London, and Nicky comes up to me and says, hey, man, I just talked to Mick Jagger, and Mick Taylor just quit the Rolling Stones. I'd like to give him your phone number. Do you mind? I said, man, you can't do that. I don't want him to have my phone number. So anyway, I thought it was just kind of passing conversation. So about a couple of weeks later, over the Christmas holidays, I got a call from Mick Jagger. He said, well, what are you doing the first week of January? And I said, why don't you fly over to Rotterdam, Holland, and come to this hotel, and we're going to do some jamming and playing. And so he called back again, and of course, the first time he called, I didn't really believe it was him. My bass player answered our phone in our little Muse house in London and said, hey, it's Mick. He's on the telephone. Of course, everybody I knew at the time that worked for The Who was named Mick, so it could have been a dozen Micks. And so I started talking. I thought they were playing a joke on me on the other end, but it turned out to be Jagger. And anyway, we kind of laughed that off. And he called back and says, hey, I got you a 6 a.m. flight to Rotterdam, Holland. And can you make the plane? And I said, yep. So I got there about, it didn't take long. It's only a 30-minute flight or something. By the time I got there, it's about 7:30 or so. So he said, call room 401. I called. He goes, yeah, we're just going to bed. I'll call you about 5 o'clock in the afternoon. And so, you know, here I am stuck in Rotterdam, Holland. You know, I mean, I'm riding, rent a bicycle. I'll go out and buy a sweater. I come back and stare at the telephone, watch TV. I'm just totally wide awake, all, you know, waiting, waiting. So about 7 o'clock, they called me and said, come up to Key's room on the 7th floor. Walked down there. They all, Tony Sanchez answered the door. He says, hey, Robert, it's Tony Sanchez. He ended up writing a book about all this stuff. And I'm in that book. He said, the guys are in there. So I walked in the room and it was just me and the four Rolling Stones. And we just had a talk, played some records. I played them some of the tracks I'd done. And they said, well, let's go down and eat and have something to eat and go over to our mobile recording studio, which was connected to a big building, which was part of a sort of a little town hall, you know, kind of a concert arena, little small venue thing. And the Glenn Johns was there. So we proceeded to jam 4 days and did a lot of talking. And, you know, I played on some of the Black and Blue tracks.
All right. Don't go anywhere. We'll be right back.
The Will Kane Show is now dropping 5 episodes a week. Join Fox and Friends weekend host Will Kane as he tackles the latest headlines from his unique perspective, along with thought-provoking interviews with leading figures and live calls from viewers and listeners. Listen wherever you download your favorite podcasts.
You've collaborated with such a wide range of bands and musicians. Who are the most memorable person to work with in your experience?
I guess probably Isaac Hayes. He was kind of my first big, one of the first big breaks. It was about late 69, and I was, you know, about 16 years old. And then by the time we started working, I did ready to turn 17, and started out just doing much of nothing. We got a call. I was actually still in school. I'd gotten out of school, and he had called me at my mother's house. The parents and my mother called the school and said, you need to get home. It's something important. So I went home and they said, you got to go to San Francisco. And Isaac said, meet us at the airport. And we flew to, you know, San Francisco and opened up for Led Zeppelin. So it was my first experience with Isaac Hayes, and we, at Winterland, and, it was wow. But he taught me a lot about arranging, and he was just such a great talent, great songwriter, obviously, and fantastic keyboard player, and just, you know, probably the most memorable, nicest guy. And that was a really sweet time, you know, with the style, the fashion, the haircuts, the afros, the, you know, the kind of, you know, Superfly era. You know, it was just a beautiful time. We did the David Frost show, the Johnny Carson show. I mean, we, you know, toured everywhere. It was just great. Did a lot of recording. And
Okay. So, Robert, you're 17 years old, and you are opening, well, A, you're touring with Isaac Hayes, which is insane. Your first gig with him is opening for Led Zeppelin in, I remember, Winterland, by the way. Oy vey, that's in South San Francisco. And then you're doing the Tonight Show. I mean, how did you now? Okay, at that age, and the kind of lifestyle that people lead in that industry. I mean, did you go head first into it? How did you keep a level head at that age? That's incredible. Oh, wait. Before you answer that, how did people know how good you were? Like, how did Isaac Hayes know that this 16-year-old was an ace guitarist? Like, how did that come out? Was it word of mouth?
Well, I was working in the mailroom at Stax. I went there. We had a high school field trip. You know, you get on a bus, go to a factory or whatever. So this day they said, hey, we're going to Stax Studio. I said, hey, I'm all over it. Let's go. So I'm walking in. I made some homemade business cards in the art room and walked up this real friendly black guy named William Brown, and I handed him my business card. I said, I'm a guitar player. And he says, well, you don't look like a guitar player. And I just had like HIS slacks on and a tie or whatever. And I said, no, I can play. And he ended up calling me the following week. He was the singer of the Mad Lads, who were a famous group on Stax. And they had a couple of like top R&B hits. And the guitar player had gotten sick for a job, and he called me the very next weekend and wanted me to come play. And so this was, you know, Martin Luther King had just gotten killed. The city was just kind of all up in arms, so you really couldn't have a black person come to your home and pick you up. So I had to sneak out of my house and go around the corner and meet all the black guys, the band, and go to the gig. And and that's where it kind of started. And then I met Roland Robinson, who was the bass player of the Buddy Miles Express, who had just gotten off tour, opening up for Jimi Hendrix. And he was playing with Eddie Floyd. And he said, we had cut some demos for Sir Mack Rice, who wrote the song Mustang Sally. And we were just all in the studio one day and said, Isaac has to start a band now. Hot Buttered Soul had just gone, it went gold in 3 weeks and platinum in 5 weeks. And he's getting all these offers to play. And they were saying, well, we want you to be the guitar player. I said, well, you know, you got two or three other guys around here, Michael Toles and Bobby Manuel and whatever. And they said, no, man, we want you. And so we had a jam, and Isaac says, man, this is the guy we're taking. So that's how it kind of happened.
Wow, that's fantastic. So the earlier question was, you know, was this over, like, it sounds, when you're talking about it now, it sounds very matter of fact, and you're very calm and like, as you're talking about it. But when you were that age, was this overwhelming to you, or were you so confident in your talent that you knew that this just made total sense, that this was a thoroughly natural thing for you to be doing?
Yeah, it was pretty natural, Greg. Of course, the players were just outstanding. I mean, the band was just unstoppable. I mean, you know, there was an all-star cast of just great. And I was the only white guy in the band, you know, so it was great. I mean, the energy level these guys were putting out, I mean, it was like, you know, a cross between Mountain Cream and Curtis Mayfield. I mean, it was just intense. I mean, it was a power band, but a soul band at the same time. And had a lot of power to it. And, you know, of course, we had, you know, some this beautiful musicians, Lester Snell, who got the Oscar and the Grammy for Shaft of Arrangements, and still one of my dear friends today. I use him all the time in the studio. And some of the guys have passed on, like Roland Robinson. He ended up writing Infatuation for Rod Stewart. It was just an all-star cast. Very similar to people you surround yourself with. You know, you just got magic combo, you know?
Mm-hmm. Man. So I asked you, like, who was great and wonderful. Do you have any – who was the worst person you ever had to work with? Are you probably not going to tell me, but I'm going to ask anyway. But is there somebody that was, like, the opposite of Isaac Hayes?
Yeah. Well, not really. I mean, I can't really recall anybody. I mean – you know, it wasn't the happiest time with the Rolling Stones. I mean, you can read all the books and see what was going on in 75. It was a little bit, mad, but then those guys were just fantastic too. I mean, they were all just great, lovable characters, and they were so nice to me, and, incredible musicians. I mean, it's almost an enigma of how they work. You know, if you see them individually, you go, man, if these guys get together, they can't be that good. And then you put them all together, they're just ultimately fantastic. So, you know, that was a big thrill. And of course, with Entwistle, he was just great too. I mean, I don't really have anything that just pops in my mind that really is sort of a bummer or a really hard to work with person. I mean, many new artists that are, I could tell you nightmare stories about them, but you know.
I want to hear one. Tell me one nightmare story about somebody I might know.
Well, man, that should have been a question from yesterday so I could sleep on it. I don't really, I mean, you know, I did a session with Mark Bolan. He was this is so nice as could be. And, you know, I guess, you know, you're a lot of this stuff you're doing in England or you're doing in New York or, you're, you know, it's a Southern guy. It's different. You come in, you got the Southern accent. I'm, you know, walking a little slow, playing too fast. You know, I don't know. I guess I sort of learned how to be a little bit diplomatic. Not always when I was a kid, but, you know, just kind of go with the flow. So I don't really, you know, Alice Cooper, that was great. You know, just I think the Judds were a little bit of a pain in the ass. That's about all I can say.
The Judds. You know, I don't know why I'm not surprised. You actually, you played with Mark Bolan. I mean, that's kind of interesting because he's like such a mystery. I mean, he died. I believe it was a car accident, right? I think.
Another 27 club. He died in a Mini Cooper accident driving home. His wife, girlfriend was the driver who was the backup singer in his band. And she was sort of like a ex Ike Ed or something. She was a beautiful, you know, black backyard singer girl. And I think her name was Gloria, but that was very sad. But I had, been involved a little bit with Jeff Beck recording here in Memphis. I was, you know, doing stuff around the studio where they did the Jeff Beck Group solo album with Max Middleton and my good friend Bobby Tench, who was the singer. Still talk to Bobby today, but they ended up dragging me back to England, and it was through that was 72, and that was I'd met Mark, and he'd had an album I did called Sandra Rhodes, who was the singer for Rhodes, Chalmers, and Rhodes. It was a three-team backup singing group that did all the Al Green records, a lot of the Stag. You hear them on disc records on the radio all the time, every day still. And she'd done a solo record, and I'd played on that at Sam Phillips' studio. And somehow Mark Bolan had a copy of it. He was infatuated with it. I don't even know how he got it so fast, but, you know, promo records get out pretty quick, and he wanted to meet me, so we ended up going and hanging out and going down to the studio in London and doing some jamming on the song demo.
You know, it's amazing. I mean, you're kind of like I almost thought of Forrest Gump or Zelig, but you seem to be everywhere where there's important music being played. Did you ever get sucked into the hard partying lifestyle, or were you pretty level headed through all this?
Oh, pretty much level-headed. I mean, everybody went through the kind of hard thing of maybe 79 to 83 or 4. That was about it for me. You know, I had enough. But, you know, I was definitely sort of just a laid-back, you know, pot-smoking and kind of cool dude, you know. Wasn't drinking much. I mean, I didn't really start drinking until I was in my 30s. So I was more into working out with karate and, you know, jumping rope and trying to stay fit and being skinny, you know, 120 pounds. Wish those days were back.
Now I have a question for myself, a selfish question. So during, I decided to take up guitar about, I don't know. I had a guitar for a long time, and then work tore me away from it. I was making progress teaching myself guitar, and then I hit a wall, and I realized how I hit a wall. Is that you can't go on YouTube and just pick videos and play from some, like, you can learn like a riff, but you don't learn anything. Do you have any advice for me?
There's some old videos. I'll try to get you some that actually taught you how to play guitar. They're not around much. They when they were out there on like VHS or Betamax, you know, I don't know. I don't even think they're on DVD. I'll dig up a couple of those. There was one, I think, from Rick Derringer that was very cool, and it actually was informative, you know.
Yeah.
But the best thing to do is to find another friend and play with another person. You know, I mean, that is the best way. Your neighbor, or I mean, as many people as you know, there's somebody in the woodpile that's got to have a guitar that strums on it. Try to get to a jam session, and just sit there and play Gloria until you learn it backwards, you know?
Yeah. You know, it's funny because the only time I've ever really learned anything, I have a friend named Paul who is, you know, I'm sure you've talked to Joni, who's my producer. Her husband plays excellent guitar, self-taught. And when I'm around him and we play, I learn things. But when I'm alone, I find myself going in stupid directions and directions that I think I take because they're easy, and as opposed to directions that might be challenging and whatnot. So I see that, like, if you're with a friend, the friend could challenge you, and especially if the friend's way better, which he is, then that helps too, because I don't think I add anything to his skill set other than maybe he, you know, it's a great way to, like, test his attention span, having to listen to my noodling. Tell me about, okay, your latest album, I'm Alive. Where can people find it? Is it on iTunes? And why did you call it I'm Alive as well?
Well, I called it I'm Alive basically because the first track is a remake of a Holly song called I'm Alive. And it's on Burger Records, which is really probably the closest thing to a real record label out there. You know, those guys, Sean and Lee, they just run a really tight ship. I can't say enough good things about Burger Records. I mean, we've sold a lot of cassettes. They're bringing back the cassette market, National Cassette Day. They're selling cassette machines. I mean, they're vinyl, the high grade thick vinyl. But the record, I call it that. And a good little point on that record too is Alan Aldridge, a dear friend of mine, who was the Beatles artist. He did Beatles Illustrated. He did the Apple Records logo, the Hard Rock Cafe logo, just beautiful art. He did the, you know, House of Blues logo. But he worked with Lennon and McCartney close and did the beautiful book Beatles Illustrated. He did the cover, and that was the last album cover he designed before he passed away.
Wow.
Yep. So it's a great record. It's got Jimmy Jameson, my friend from Memphis, who was in the band Survivor. He's on two tracks. I even have Mick Taylor from the Stones on a couple of tracks. I got, there's just some great, great people on the record, you know. And Mick Taylor just plays the best slide guitar. I mean, he's right there with Dwayne Allman. So he's just an incredible guy, you know, and it was great. I've recorded it all over the world. We mixed it down and mastered it at Abbey Road. And we also mixed a lot of it in Castleford, England, at Chairworks. But, I mean, it was recorded, you know, California, New York. I mean, I worked on it all over the world, finally got it ready. And it's out on Burger Records along with the 40th anniversary of Close Personal Friend. And we plan to have more product coming out on that soon. Even the Missing Chrysalis album from 1975.
That's fantastic. By the way, thank you so much for the cassette machine. It is amazing. It's hilarious. It was such a great gift, in the cassettes especially. But I would urge all the viewers, listeners here, to go to it's Burger Records. If you go to the website, and you got to get both records. You got to get I'm Alive, but you also have to get Close Personal Friend, because you just can't go wrong with that album. Both albums are great. Close Personal Friend is it's just a classic. It's just one of it's a great album in any era. Was it 1980 then?
Well, we started working on the record probably technically around 75, 76.
Yeah,
and
right.
We signed the deal in 77. It came out in 78.
Right.
And then the momentum stayed through 79. I think we sold a little over 200,000 records. And, it hit the Billboard charts at 98. But by the time it broke the top 100 in all the three charts, Cashbox and whatnot. Mm-hmm. But, and in England as well, we had four or five singles in England just off the record. I mean, the record was released everywhere, you know. I mean, all over Europe, Japan. Ensign was a monster. They had Dutch Phonogram behind them, and it was just, you know, released all over in various forms, various labels. I've never seen so many records, but I've been living in London the last 3 years, and I've been coming across records I had out on labels I didn't even know existed, you know, so...
It was so amazing seeing you. It was an unusual concert. It was you, the Knack, and the Police. It was in Zellerbach, 1979, which is the auditorium in Berkeley. And you weren't announced until later. And I was like, holy crap. I know I'm more interested in this guy than the Police. And the Police just had Outlandish Demore Out, and they didn't have enough songs. If I remember correctly, in their encore, they had to repeat two songs. And they ended up doing the song with the blow-up doll as well. But and then, of course, sandwiched between You, who did a great set, and The Police, who were okay, was The Knack, which were just, like, I never heard of them. And then they exploded, I guess, almost 2 months later with My Sharona. Did you ever end up playing anywhere with the Ramones at all during that period? Or I was curious if you ever ran into the Ramones, because you seem to know everybody, but it's just a long shot.
I did run into Joey Ramone several times over the years, and I ran into those guys at the record plant when I was finishing up Close Personal Friend, because I finished it up, mixing it and a couple overdubs in New York, and right next door to The Clash. So I was there for a month, and I was with The Clash every day because I saw them in the hallway and had sandwiches with them, and ended up becoming friends with Topper Heaton, the drummer. And when I moved back to England in 86, I ended up playing on Topper Heaton's solo record called Waking Up. And Bobby Tinch, my friend, was on that as well, and who was the singer for Jeff Beck Band. So, I ended up hooking back up with Topper and hanging out with him and the bass player some, Paul. And so I was around The Clash a lot. And
I love The Clash.
The Ramones a little bit, not a whole lot, but I did see them. One day I was walking in New York with a friend of mine, and we saw Joey way down in the Village, and then we were up the Upper East Side, and there he was walking right in front of us again. and then we went to dinner that night, and he was at the restaurant, so we saw him three different places in New York. So it was pretty
interesting. It'd be great if there were actually three Joey Ramones. That's amazing. You know, The Clash. I was one of those young kids that was just blown away by The Clash. I had everything that they put out and posters and saw them, and I ended up becoming, I guess I would say, friends with Mick Jones. But I ended up having him on my show. We went out drinking, and then I hooked up with him in London. And just a wonderful guy, absolutely wonderful. I interviewed Joe Strummer years ago, but that was over the phone roughly a month before he died, and right after 9/11, somewhere around there in the fall. But an incredible band. What about, did you ever meet, I this is my last stupid question, did you ever meet anybody in the Cramps? Because I've always found them to be one of the most fascinating groups, but I don't know if that's your cup of tea.
Well, they actually did. They did some album work down here in Memphis at the studio I was worked at for 40 years, Ardent Studios. They did a record here. I think Jim Dickinson produced them, a friend of mine.
Yes, yes, that's right.
Yeah. So yes, yeah, I have met all of those people.
I had a weird evening at Lux Interior and Poison Ivy's house in like 2003. I was also a Cramps fan as well. I was just curious because, you know, I think 75% of the band is now dead. The surviving member, Poison Ivy, still around. Kid Congo Powers is doing other stuff, but like Brian Gregory, who was kind of crazy, Lux Interior, Nick Knox, they're all dead. All right, I'm going to shut up because now I'm rambling. So fans of this show have to be fans of Robert Johnson. Go to Burger Records online. Order his music right now. And Robert, it's been a pleasure talking to you, and I'm going to keep bothering you, and we have to get together either when I'm in LA or if I get to, I am going to be in Memphis, by the way, I think in August or September, but we'll talk about that later offline.
Okay, my brother.
Thank you, sir. It was great talking to you.
Thank you, Greg. I'll see you soon, my friend.
Kudlow on Fox Business is now on the go for podcast fans. Get key interviews with the biggest business newsmakers of the day. The Kudlow podcast will be available on the go after the show every weekday at foxbusinesspodcasts.com or wherever you download your favorite podcasts.